Good morning, everybody. Guten Morgen. Bienvenue and welcome. Willkommen. I am your host, Sean Benson. Welcome to Chatting Between Takes. Oh, the medium Tim Hortons is kicking in, my friends, as is the bagel belt. Woo! Needed 1,000 calories to start the day. Actually, didn't not. I'm off to do a bit of karate, a bit of sword in Kitchener right now, so I'm driving across the 401. Thought I'd say hello. I think I said I was going to do this podcast last night. All right, we're closing the gap on the procrastinativeness because, hey, it's not days. There you go. I'll post this up this afternoon. Might do a little bit of a scattercast because I won't have enough time to, you know, chat for a while before I get to Kitchener, but then I'm driving back to Guelph to visit my parents, and then I'm going to go back to Toronto, and then I actually want to separate it a bit. Big shout out, Hannah Anderson. She likes the music, as do some other people. I've gotten some private messages. So might throw in another tune today. I think I know the one. A much belated homage will be coming your way. Got some good news this week, you know. Read the Chatting Between Takes, read the fact that I'm a working actor, and that's part of what I get to share with you guys. I booked a nice fucking role. Third lead on a film called Arc, Netflix movie, which I'm pretty excited about. It's a feature film, but Netflix is funding it. I love that company, man. I just love what they're doing. The two leads are Robbie Amell and Rachel Taylor from some shows you might have seen. And then look them up. They might be on one of your favorite shows. I think they both have sci-fi cred. And I don't really want to get into the plot of this. But it's going to be super fucking rad. I love this script, and I love my part. So I am on lockdown mode, my friends. I am on workout multiple times a day and just get a little jacked up, you know. There's no specific reason. I mean, the part I'm playing definitely can use, you know, a little more muscle and a little more leanness. And while a week and a half till I start shooting isn't a ton of time, I'm in pretty good shape right now. But it's a mental thing. You know, so going and doing two workouts today with my sensei, and then, you know, I'll probably do some biking tonight, and I'll cut out some of the dairy that keeps that layer of subcutaneous fat on, and blah, 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 so that when that camera's rolling, it's just one less layer of self-consciousness. And you know how much I believe this work has to be revelatory to be of any real interest, which, Adam, I'll get to your question in a sec, because it touches on that. Here's the life that I live as an actor, and then what can lead to sort of bookings. I don't know if this is useful or not, because at the end of the day, assuming a certain talent level and life preparedness, I do think the casting gets to be a bit random. There's only so many people in a mix, but you might just want the guy with the blue eyes because it, you know, he reminds you of your brother or whatever, and you're one of the producers on the show. And you don't know why you're making that choice. You're just like, I like the blue-eyed guy. It's legitimately how some stuff gets cast at the end of the day. So, and that's neither good nor bad, because like we've talked about on the show, I've benefited from that as well as raged at that. By the way, this goes back to something I was talking about. I mentioned a producer of a show with Katie Boland, and I was like, that guy, you know, that guy's the reason I didn't get the show, blah, blah, blah. I also talked about an acting teacher, his assistant, who sort of scammed me out of a class for a while. I just want to be real clear, because I was listening back to one of these to try and... Sometimes I listen back to the podcast to see who I mentioned so I could, you know, shout it out. Neither of those stories, quote unquote, are true. They're true to me. Now, well, fuck, we may as well just go here. I have someone I care deeply about and love and shall remain nameless who's gotten a mental health diagnosis of a sort of dementia, Alzheimer's nature. And it's really got me thinking about... I don't know, what Shakespeare would call madness. And the difficulty of a madness that insists that it's everyone else's. So if somebody feels like they're being attacked by everyone around them and tried to be, you know, drugged and kept down, it's hard to get that person to take drugs that have been prescribed by a neurologist because they actually believe this thing. And I was chatting with my brother about it, and the idea being like, well, yeah. I mean, if you thought someone was poisoning your water and actually thought it, would you drink it when they handed it to you? And it's a bit of a conundrum. I don't know the answer. I don't, I you know, everyone I've been talking to about this has been beautifully open, anyone who has experience, with the difficulty of it. Because there's just a consensus, and it's just for healthcare, and it's just for love. And this person thinks you're trying to attack or oppress or, you know, and there's no motive. No one has any motive other than to, you know, A, prolong the goodness and stave off the badness. And, yeah, prevent, you know, psychotic episodes of rage or depression. So... anyways, like, really, really sort of dealing with that right now. I alluded to it last show. So that's the sort of undercurrent to everything that's happening with me right now. So that when I'm getting ready to audition for all this stuff, I'm not that concerned about it. Now, this is a dichotomy because I'm 100% concerned about it. And so 2 weeks ago for me, sort of quote-unquote pilot season starts. For the uninitiated, pilot season is where in sort of January, February, March, the U.S. shows, you know, there's hundreds of them being created every year. They don't all get to you on network because a lot of them don't get past what's called a pilot, a single episode that then the advertisers on Wall Street basically go, eh, that one's not going to sell, no, ooh, that one will. Let's put our money behind it and order more episodes. That's kind of how it goes, you know. Your TV, by the way, is decided by advertisers. Who watches and goes, that's it, is not some sort of, like, voting neutral body. It's advertisers. And they're neutral in that they're using their own investment savviness to decide what you'll like. But we've talked about this before. The only reason TV shows exist is to hold your attention from one ad to another. It's the only reason a supposedly good newspaper exists, i.e. not a totally skewered rag. Still just to hold your attention from one ad to the next. And then obviously as we're into new media, the models shift a little, you know. But that's why you have pop-ups on your screens. That's why clickbait exists. You know, you want to know 13 of your favorite 90 stars and how they look now? Well, you have to click through 13 pages, and then that generates traffic. So whoever wrote that article just gets a pat on the back because they drove traffic. Well, that's all Seinfeld did, was he drove your eyes to advertising. Not a good or bad thing, something definitely to be aware of. There's no judgment to that. I mean, God, advertisers have... I work for advertisers, and I love it. I have no qualm about it. And I think part of the reason for that is that I love material goods. I'm always shopping for stuff. And Seinfeld was on Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, and he's like, don't you just love that you can be watching TV? And then you, like, see a burger, and you can just go get that burger? I love it, too. Back real quick to the idea about the sort of mental insanity stuff is, yeah, I have a perception of, let's say, those producers or teachers doing things, but I don't know how any of that unfolded. Zero. Like, actually zero knowledge. All I know is in my version of, like, a isolation tank, the food I wanted didn't get handed in through the slat. You know, and so at that point, I just make up a story. I just make up a story and go, oh, well, blah, 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 blah. So, as I always like to challenge you guys, what stories are you making up that you have absolutely no actual evidence of other than what you wanted didn't happen? Now, I own that I make up those stories, and I hope I let those stories go over time. I think that's what we call forgiveness. But also, the term I like to talk about is amends. Amends tends to include forgiveness, tends to include maybe a version of an apology, but most importantly includes amended behavior. So I think I mentioned this on a podcast. I will not be phoning my agent for feedback this year. I will not be phoning my agent to ask where we're at on a certain project. You know, am I going to get it or not? And it's simply because all it does is feed into my own story generating machine. I've never not gotten a part because I didn't call my agent and go, hey, are we still in the mix for that thing? Now, I've got a great agent and he will get the information. But it's useless information. It means nothing. Because again, it's like, well, why do you want to break up? Yeah, but why? Yeah, but why? Yeah, but why? It's a version of that. It's childish. You know, it's the thing's going to come my way or it isn't. And this has taken me years. I'm 41 years old and it's starting to sink in that you'll get the part or you won't. And that extra phone call isn't going to be what makes it happen. Now, by the way, caveat to that. There have been times in my career where I was missing. What I mean is missing the mark. And having an agent get feedback, you know, to the cast directors. I once had my first real agent phone and go, honey, they think you're on drugs or crazy. And I hadn't booked any work with this agent, so I was ready to be fired. And I wasn't doing drugs at this point. I probably was crazy. Still am after. I met my whole lover on the street last night. She seemed so glad to meet me. I just smiled. Oh, shit, this is going to go high. And we talked about some old times and we drank ourselves some beer. Still crazy. Hold on. Still crazy after all these years. Something like that. I'm still crazy after all these years. However, her subsequent sentence was, but they can't wait to see you next week. So good or bad, I've got this thing called watchability. It doesn't always come in a... again, I'm going to the Seinfeld thing. I've been watching Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. There's likable, there's lovable, and then there's like interesting... And who knows, you know, Seinfeld was like, I'm likable, but Kevin Hart, you're lovable. It was pretty great. Because these distinctions matter. You know, they do matter in terms of how you're going to get cast. Are you going to get to do, you know, the film for the Hallmark Network, which probably isn't going to have, you know, the death scene really involve an insane amount of pain for anybody. You know, or an indie drama where you got to go the distance. So anyways, this insanity is one that's pervaded my life, and I don't mean other people's. I mean misconstruing what's happening or making up what's happening entirely. There's not even information to construe other than what I need to be true because I need a villain. So anyways, that's one of those things where those situations happen often. 2016, I'm working away from that. Don't need the feedback. Other than, like I said, with that one agent, we could use the idea that, okay, something you're doing is compelling, but something you're doing is off-putting. And over time, we found a way to simplify my work in the audition room, which is what I'm actually leaping forward to. So I'm trying to abandon story. I'm trying to abandon need for villain. I'm trying to take responsibility for not just, by the way, how I feel, obviously how I act, but I'm trying to take responsibility for the fact that I have a really good life right now. So I've talked about how there was a certain... I mean, my parents would tell me, you were such a happy kid. I remember once hitting my brother in the back of the head with a hockey stick. Another time hitting him on the back of the head with a hammer. I remember I used to, like, rage often. Like, really rage. They get called into school every year to be told, yeah, his marks are good, but he's not. I've told you guys this. Why would they keep insisting I was such a happy kid? Well, it's pretty obvious. If I wasn't a happy kid, they'd have had to do something about it. So if Emily's like, we got to change the kitty litter, and I'm like, no, it's fine. Well, I'm only saying it's fine so I don't have to change the kitty litter. So someone's like, hey, you know, your kid's behavior's a bit off. No. He's great. He's a happy kid. Why do I say that? Because there's elements of believing I need to be a certain kind of person that I adopted from that. So I created a sense of, well, my parents keep telling me I was a happy kid, so I guess I'm a happy kid. And therefore, this isn't blaming, this is fact, I believe. Whoa, wait a minute, didn't you just say, yes, I did, but it's a fact that this occurred. See, that part's fact. There's a difference between fact and extrapolation to what I want to believe. Fact is, I had a ton of behavioral stuff going on. Fact is, my parents used to tell me what a happy kid I was. Fact is, I felt like I had to be happy. Anything else is starting to extrapolate into gaps of, well, then this must mean. And that's valid. You know, that's how we think and go, oh, could that be true? The thing, though, that we have to be able to do is experiment once we theorize to actually create a theory that's legit. If we're going to have it to have any weight or meaning. I'm not worried about any of this having any weight or meaning, though. I'm just driving a karate. So the feeling that I have to be a certain way has pervaded, and Adam, this is going to get to your question, a lot of my existence. And that's really what I'm talking about with abandoning this story and stuff. I'm not fucking cheating, stealing, lying, killing myself with drugs or booze, so I don't have to be anyway. I can say dumb shit, I can offend you, I can whatever. There may be consequences, but I don't have to be a certain, there's no box I have to live in. So, pilot season starts a couple weeks ago, and I have like 7 or 8 auditions a week for the last 2 weeks. And I start out going to my studio every night. You know, the first one I had on the Monday, I think I went to the studio 4 times in a row with Emily and Elise Bauman, fantastic actress, and we just worked on stuff. And then when like Atticus Mitchell would come over to do a self-tape, we'd work on maybe a few of my lines for a bit. But it was this constant work. And the feedback started to roll in even after the first week, and it was super positive, like really positive. These things were going well. Even by the end of week one, I'm just tired for the Friday afternoon audition or whenever it was. Just physically tired. And it's like audition number 8, and I have to read scripts for all of these, and I have to learn, you know, 4 to 10 pages of lines, depending. So I'm going out for this film, and I learned my lines in the waiting room, half on the way there. So I go in and I feel wonderful. I've been chatting with this casting director throughout the week on different parts. I feel very me. And I know the lines because I learn lines quickly. But again, on this one, I haven't been to the studio for this one. I haven't been doing my Meisner repetition on this one. I haven't even said it out loud once because excuse me, Emily was super busy herself, and so we didn't have time to connect on this. So zero preparation, like literally zero. But that's not true. That's like saying, oh, did you get into a bar fight last night? Yeah. Did you win? Yeah. Well, you didn't even warm up. I mean, were you in your karate gi? Did you do your stretching and calisthenics before and do all your basics to warm up? What are you talking about? I just hit the guy. Well, on this one, I just hit the guy because I've been preparing for all these auditions ever since I basically started taking, well, probably since I did my first piano rehearsal at age 6. What, I'm in front of people? I need to do something? Great, I will. So what happened is zero preparation, and I was actually very open to the vibe. I hope this makes sense what I'm saying. People, and obviously actors, I could pick up, plus the director was in the room, which is such a treat, such a treat, because even off the director, I'm getting a sense of who he is. It's not, I'm not thinking about it. It's just called being in a room. And so as I start doing my thing, you know, you can, they're watching a monitor and you can feel a bit of the response and you can start to further, again, this is all, it's like doing, it's like playing jazz. You can feel where it's going to go. You know, I've been talking about this lately with some friends, like there's a lot better guitar players out there, but sometimes I'll be playing guitar with someone who can play guitar better, but they're not a better musician. Most people can play guitar better than me, but I'm a pretty good musician. And whether it's the fact that I've played trumpet in bands and drums in bands and, you know, used to play saxophone for fun for a while, like, I don't really care what I'm playing if I'm part of the deal. Because that, I think that's one of the gifts of playing in school bands, is that you're part of the deal, but you're not always at the forefront. You're filling out the sound. And you're playing your part. You're part of. And then every once in a while, you know, I think I played first trumpet for a bit, so I'd get the odd, like, little lead. But again, you might even just carry the melody for 2 seconds. But the melody was not always the most interesting part of that stuff, by the way. And when I used to sing in choir, I was bass in theater school, so that was especially not the melody. And it was lovely to just build those things underneath. Anyways, the point is that with all that stuff, we're talking about a lifetime of, hey, I'm just in a room. Maybe I generally know the words. And by the way, this is a, hey, if anybody thinks acting's easy and your job's harder, I don't know, you might be right, because I actually get to hold the paper in my hand as well with the lines on it. Although I'm pretty sure if you're working in some kind of a corporate or whatever and you're doing the PowerPoint, you got the words up there on the screen too. And then it's your job to fill in what they mean. Hello, that's what I'm doing. So, do the thing, they liked it, they brought me back for a different part. Didn't prepare any more for the second one, really didn't. By the way, not only didn't, that person's diagnosis I'm talking about came in right before that audition, and the Canadian Screen Awards were announced, which is like Best Actor and Movie nominations, and I didn't get one, but my film Kept Woman, that I'm so proud of, did, and I was fucking pissed for like 15 minutes. I was like, how the fuck is my movie the best movie that I'm the lead of? Like, put anyone else in that movie and tell me it would still get nominated. I'm doing that thing. And again, Damon, we used to talk about this. Obviously, I believe that. Obviously, I believe that. Why would I think that I should be in your film that's going to get an Oscar nomination? And by the way, hey, look at this. Was a lead in a film and it got a Canadian Screen Award nomination. So I'm not totally crazy about that. I'm not wrong, but I didn't get the nomination. So I literally find this out right before I am about to go in the audition room. Let me be really clear. When I say find this out, I didn't have some assistant come and tap me on the shoulder. I didn't have some neural net linked to the internet. I was in the waiting room doing chemistry reads, and I decided to go on my phone and look up the CSA nominations. I was choosing. This didn't fall in my lap. I was choosing to look this shit up. And I was choosing what Eckhart Tolle would call an amplification of my pain body. I have a woe is me problem. No matter how happy and well I am supposed to be, I sit there and go, fuck, the world's against me. Here's another example of it. Now, because I'm not a total idiot, this did not feed into the part. This did not feed into the energy of the character I'm creating. So the way I thought about it is, hey, if you get a nomination, your balls are going to be as big as fucking China. So you're going to walk in that room and own it. If you don't get a nomination, you're going to be pissed and feel like shit and need to fucking destroy something. That works for this guy too. That actually probably works better. So then go in, do this read. So I'm literally sitting in this chemistry read. There's other actors in the room. The director's there. And I'm fucking, like, dark. I'm pissed about the familial thing with the diagnosis. I'm pissed about the CSA thing. And I'm just, like, you know, I don't even want to be there. But if I really didn't want to be there, I wouldn't walk in the room. And again, this is something I own and I hope you own too. Don't say you don't want to be somewhere that you are unless you're A, obligated for real, not some bullshit obligation you've created in your head because of, you know, a sense of self that nobody else cares about. Like a real obligation, like I'll meet you Tuesday. But if you don't want to be somewhere and you're going there, you do want to be there. You're just making it up. So that's what I'm saying. I like people who quit acting. I'm going to quit acting. And then their agent calls with an audition for a Spielberg movie, and they go, I got an audition for a Spielberg movie. It's like, I thought you quit. Well, you didn't quit. You were just bummed it wasn't going well and wanted to take ownership and a bit of control over your life, which I get, by the way. I've internally quit acting 100 times. It makes no difference, though. It really makes no difference. But more often than not, I have found that when I audition for things feeling the way I felt on that day, a lot of times I'm out of my own way. Not 100% of the time, but I'd say I book more things when I don't care. And it sucks. I hate faking not caring because I can't. So then I just do care. And then it's a little eager. It's like I remember once I had a crush on a girl in high school. And then one of my brother's friends was dating her sister. I'm like 13 or 14. And then I remember Melanie Howell was her name. And her sister Ginger was dating Rich. And then, you know, we always kind of danced around each other. We never got together. And then one day, I was like, you know, she's like, call me at 9:15 or whatever, one of these things, you know. And then I call at 9:15. And later Rich goes, hey, man, you know, I don't think things are going to work with you and Melanie. And I was like, what are you talking about? I don't know. I think she might like me. Or we always hang out. And he goes, yeah, I don't know. She said something interesting when you called. I was like, what? He's like, the phone rang. And she's like, oh, 9:15. There's Sean. And to this day, I still don't get that. I still don't get that when I was a fucking crackhead in L.A., and I would stand chicks up right, left, and center. And I would fucking leave the bar that I went to them with and just disappear to go get high or whatever. Or leave with another chick. They would want me more. I still don't get that. Because I don't want people more who do that. Fuck them, people who do that. Russell, Mikey, fuck that guy. Like that guy. Fuck that person, because that's not my thing. So I kind of have always done that golden rule on that one. But apparently the platinum rule is treat people how they want to be treated, not treat people as you would be treated, which is really interesting. Supposedly there's a concept in business, the platinum rule, which is maybe why I've never been great at business, because I treat people the way I'd like to be treated. If you say 9:15, I'd like you to call at 9:15. I've probably scheduled a very dense day. And I'm probably going to the gym right after, and I'm probably coming from something right before. Hopefully not, because all I'm really trying to do in life is nap. But I've probably scheduled a pretty dense day. I'm not talking romantically when I'm 13, but you know what I'm saying. Those seeds were laid early. And by the way, even at 13, I was probably coming from ballet, going to volleyball practice, and then going home to practice guitar. So anyways, I don't get that then. And I don't get it now when I'm an actor and I'm screen testing for a part and I fucking want this part. I want, you know, everything that's going to come with it. The time on set, the script's cool, the money's good. And I'm supposed to pretend I don't want it? It's absurd. It's like, let's just say I want it and then let's just do the work. But I know that every time I go in and I don't want it or don't care, this has happened so many times. When I was screen testing for General Hospital, I watched General Hospital that week. And I was like, oh shit, how do I get out of this? And that's no slag to, yes it is. It's not my show. I don't watch soap operas. That said, that still was one of the best experiences I could have imagined. Because, again, I had no preconceptions. In fact, I had an anti-preconception. So, yeah, there's this weird not caring. Went in for not only just the audition, but the screen test. Just, there were other things in my life that mattered way more, including the lines. But I also made a lot of calculated choices without calculating them. I hope that makes sense. I don't know. A lot of rambling about booking a part. At the end of the day, it's random. I'm just kind of describing, I hope. Here's the thing. I really am trying to get away from this story that I tell myself about what I'm like and what it means. So, I don't know if anything I just said adds up to what happened, i.e. getting the role. I'm so excited. I'm shooting for like 15 days all through February, which is like most days. It kills an LA trip me and Emily booked. Hey man, book a trip, book a part. But yes, it's definitely one of those things where I still don't want to get into some kind of, well, then that must be how it is. There is no how it is. Everything's a one-off. Everything's a one-off. Every day's a one-off. Truly. Now, we know that that's not totally true because you can consistently elicit the same reaction through the same sort of response. That's what Pavlov is, right? You ring a bell, a dog salivates because the dog relates the bell to the food, and you've basically created a causal pathway there. I don't know that that's possible in the whole acting community. I really don't. There's ups and downs, and for me, this is an up. All right, I'm a karate, my friends. I'll chat with you a little bit more on the way to go visit my mom and dad afterwards. Hello, everybody. We're back. I just had a phenomenal sword workout this morning with my teacher, Sensei Dauphin. I just love the shit, you know, drive to Kitchener in the dark, train hard, almost 2 hours, go have a coffee. Now I'm going to see the folks. This is a good morning. And like I've talked about, you know, can't do something an hour away if you don't also enjoy the drive so that you can get an hour away. So this has been great. And I am on my way now. I'm taking the back roads to Guelph. I'm in no rush. And I also just want to chill and let the coffee percolate through my veins. Okay, I've been hinting at this question, Adam. I think a lot of what I've said is kind of relevant to it. But in any case, the question is, I'd love to hear your thoughts about playing to a performance and to an audience, and what you think about reconciling those two things when there is a strong lean one way or another. Great question. Okay, so the way I hear this, and let me know next time if I've misheard it, is that there's a sort of purity to what a part might ask for, and then there's the fact that that purity has to translate so that the audience also finds it palatable, fun, moving, whatever. So which is more important, you know? Basically, the end of your question for me is kind of my answer. Generally, I lean toward the audience because I'm the audience. Now, lately I have found a way to reconcile this for myself. So what I used to do is play to the audience because, look, my favorite performers, again, are like the song and dance man, you know, the Gene Kellys and the John Ritters and, you know, even Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future, or obviously Family Ties. Like, these are worked out bits. They're worked out bits based on an ability to be spontaneously interesting, but they're still worked out bits, right? So how much is Gene Kelly actually in love with Debbie Reynolds or the characters, you know, or how much is just the fact that he's doing, which, you know, is I think the idea about honoring the role. Because for me, acting is doing. So if I look at you and we're playing lovers and I say, I love you, I'm doing what the script requires. How I do it is where it's either a Will Ferrell, John C. Reilly comedy, or whether it's like a, you know, Ryan Gosling, fucking whoever, you know, indie drama about two male lovers. So, or how would we do it? You know, and again, a lot of that's going to come from the tone of the script, but also from who is cast. So it goes a little bit back to the aging into parts. There's also the just being into a part. So if I do a part, it's going to have a... We have these sort of goalposts, right? And it's hard to play too far outside of them. Not that the way I'm perceived necessarily dictates it. By the way, the casting director who hired me for this last part, I think I mentioned this, he once said to me after I read for this sort of Ponzi professor, holy shit, I always see you as like the dude on the motorbike and the fighting stuff. And it's like, that's about 30% of me. That Ponzi professor's probably 50 or 60% of me, but I don't get asked to do that a lot. That's fine. That doesn't mean that's not right in the center of my goalposts. You know, if I get cast a lot near the left goalpost, I'm still in my wheelhouse. And the fact that I still have so much to show is fantastic, you know, over time as these roles get offered to us. Congrats on Rain, by the way. If it's the role I'm thinking, I think I read for it and I think you're going to be brilliant in it. Either way, congrats. You're going to be awesome. So for me, I always, now the way I, so what happened was I used to play to the audience and I used to give really thin performances because I wasn't doing. I was pointing to. And you know, I have a big problem with that. I was pointing to how the performance should be without actually experiencing anything. And interestingly, the guys I talked about, whether it's Michael J. Fox, Gene Kelly, or John Ritter, they're physical performers. So they have to be doing, even if they're playing. So they're 100% engaged. And what I was finding was that while doing, let's say, a legal drama, I was pointing at a kind of guy, but I wasn't doing enough for it to be the thing I was pointing at. I wasn't lost in the action. Now, these days, I'm much more comfortable with stillness, both as a man and a performer. And so it's a lot easier, I find, to go, let's say I'm making a choice, so to speak, about, you know, the tone, right? So I'm never choosing how to say a line, but I do choose how to approach the tone. Now, at that point, I'm thinking, well, what would I want to see? You know, how would I want to see this? So, for example, Kept Woman, the movie that just got a CSA nomination, that I was the lead of, I chatted with the director because I didn't really want to do the movie because the script suggested a certain tone. So I'd have had to play to the audience without any sense of being the way I believed I could be in any convincing or interesting manner, because obviously there has to be a blend. And the director and I chatted and I said, look, for me to do this, I need to... do this. I need it to feel like this and I need to approach it like this. And by the way, that's because I would never watch that movie otherwise. So in a weird way, I'm making a decision totally based on the audience and then he goes, that's how I want to do it. Never thought about the audience again, ever, in all my script work, in all my work on set, in all my work with my scene partners. So the reason to do the film was like, it will be entertaining if it goes like this. And while obviously I was right, it's not just me that was right. Obviously, there's a whole team and awesome other actors. But I wouldn't have wanted to do the movie any other way. So, bottom line is, I don't want to be bored off my tits watching someone be a quote unquote good actor. Some of my worst work, people will be like, "Wow, you're a good actor," but it wasn't really exciting or watchable. And it goes back to that idea of likable, lovable, interesting. If none of the above are being ticked, but I'm constantly told I'm good, I might be focusing too much on being good. I ran into Damore Barnes the other day, who I love, and he and I didn't always work that well together on The Associates. We were co-leads, and we were cast as sort of adversaries. And I said to him, I was like, don't you fucking wish we could go back and play some of those scenes over without, on my end, a lot of that, like, need to be good sort of intensity. And he just laughed his ass off and we hugged each other and was like, yes, God, so much worry about stuff that has nothing to do with anything. And if I ever stepped back and said, would you want to watch this? The answer would have been no. It's a little bit too on the nose. There's a charm lacking. There's an ease lacking. Granted, the reason I couldn't step back and do that is because I didn't know how to do those things. So I had to defend my acting. And in general, you know, I think about this in terms of acting and behavior. We defend because we're afraid we can't do the new thing. I mean, come on. You're afraid of the new world in which we allow fucking Muslims, or which we allow gays, and which we, it's fear. So we go, no, 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 I like it the way it is. And then, you know, maybe to a fault we do that. Well, I was a Trump supporter to a fault with regards to being a good actor. And the irony is that I wasn't that good. You know, I go back and I watch those old episodes. There were moments of good, and I was fine, but I could have been a lot better if I'd just done my thing. And by the way, that goes back to, let's say, again, maybe it's random, but I think a lot of the reason why I'm booking more work lately is because, big picture, I was just talking to my karate teacher about this, macro, I am working my fucking ass off as an actor. It's all I'm focused on. I'm so into it. It's like, you know, I don't work standard 8 hours a day, but 8 hours of work a day, I'm focused on this stuff. Even if it's reading a script, even if it's going to the gym, but making those instinctive decisions toward a character, that's the macro. But the micro is, I don't need to fucking pour over these lines all the time. I don't need to sit and go, what's my character thinking here? Honestly, that's fucking acting 101. And even then, I don't even think it's great 101. Emily would disagree with me because she says I have an instinct that sometimes you need to, like, work on. And I'm not patting myself on the back. I didn't earn that instinct. But an instinct for a certain kind of human nature. And part of it, you know, we were talking about this the other night. The idea about the therapy and reading these Eckhart Tolle books and going to hike through the Himalayas to find myself, but also see other cultures. Like, I have an innate interest in this stuff. I love it. I'd be interested. If I wasn't an actor, I'd probably want to go be a therapist or, you know, work with people's, like, blind spots in their minds and try and help them reframe their thinking. God, this is not fucking entertaining when I realize that that's half of what I'm trying to do for myself and you guys with this podcast. But what are you going to do? It's hard to tell jokes alone. By the way, I'm going to go do some stand-up. Adam, you get my drift. I really think the performance is important for the audience because they're the ones who are going to watch it. And our box office bears this out, right? And it's what I was saying last podcast about Oscar nominations for comedies. Will Ferrell should have an Oscar nomination for his comedy work for Elf. You know, I think that's his best movie. Why do we put that over there but then pay so much money to go see it? And then we pretend that we like blah, blah, blah better. Well, I agree with the idea that we should subsidize our highest aspirations of who we are, not just honor sort of more base ones. And I think that's the idea with not honoring comedy as much. But we should change that. Let's accept who we are, as long as we're not hurting other people, and dig it. And dig it. You know, hurting other people, I don't always think includes them feeling hurt by what you say, as long as what you say isn't hurtful. You know? This microaggression idea. I don't know if I believe what I just said, though. Maybe I'm just an old cranky asshole, but I have trouble with this idea that I gotta fucking mind my P's and Q's because you might get offended. And a bit of it has to do, again, with, like, did I really do anything wrong? Like, did I put a rock through your window? Or did I not hire you? Or did I don't know, like, you know, and then, I don't know, Emily might go, yeah, but big picture, you might not hire the Indian guy if you do joke Indian accents, because you'll always see him as an Indian guy, not just as a guy. I don't know, maybe that's right. Maybe that's right. But I do know that fucking whining about every little thing. Bill Maher does this great bit where he basically points out what fucking cunts those Oregon militia guys are, and but also what fucking cunts those people who are screaming at, like, Yale or Princeton about it not being a safe enough space for them, because this isn't just an intellectually challenging environment, it's a home. And my response when I watched that one video, the liberal girl yelling, I was like, no, it is just supposed to be an intellectually stimulating environment. That isn't your home. Your home is wherever you choose to live. You're not forced to live on campus. You're not forced. And you're an adult. You know? These are the kinds of things where I think pendulums do swing too far. But then again, the argument is, are you swinging little pendulums too far so that the bigger pendulum does swing? I don't actually know what I think about that. a little bit has to do with that. No, 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 it's fine, because I don't want to change the kitty litter, and my folks don't want to change anything, because then that means that they, you know, they'd have to get up off the couch. Not that they were physically lazy, but, you know, physical work's actually easy. Changing kitty litter is a lot easier than realizing your kid's a little fucking nut bar, and it's probably has a lot to do with the environment you've created at home. That's a big job. That's a paradigm shift that has to happen. How willing are you, my friends, to shift your paradigms? How willing are you to truly change that which needs to change for you to be who you want, so that you can ultimately, well, not so that you can ultimately, because by the time you are who you want, what you get by being who you want may be less important. That's my experience, frustratingly so, which is half the reason why I didn't even want to let go of the old paradigm, is because I was afraid, yeah, but what if fucking food doesn't taste as good, and sex isn't as good, and Porsches aren't as fun? My experience has been the opposite. They're much better, but they're not the primary concern. What things are you afraid to find you and will be lost if you're actually willing to switch your paradigm, i.e. let go of the thing that's preventing you from being who you want to be and getting what you want? Oh, that's a big question. And by the way, wanting it for someone else, you know, I think about if I say to my dad, like, oh, you know, I therapy's really great. Have you thought about it? And he goes, oh, yes, that'd be great for your mother. There's no matter how much he goes to therapy, as long as he's there wanting it for her, the paradigm shift hasn't happened yet. You know, and by the way, usually when you have the paradigm shift, you don't give a shit about the other person, even if it's loving detachment, or you're just out. Because the paradigm shift means you're like, wow, what was I doing there? Why did I spend so much time insisting they do something differently? The whole point was I need to. I don't know how many other paradigm shifts there are. You know, fucking Sarah Palin literally is, you know, supposedly the party of personal responsibility, et cetera, is blaming Obama for her son's post-traumatic stress and why he's violently pulling out guns and beating up his girlfriend. How does that follow? Let's even assume there was something true to that, even though her son was sent to war under not Obama, and the party she represents is trying to cut veterans' benefits any chance they get, and Obama's fighting that. So let's forget that. So she's fucking nuts, right? Like, and anybody who, like, what I just said is a fact, it's not an opinion. So you just can look up the voting records. So she's fucking nuts. But let's even pretend that what that was true. There's where does still the personal responsibility come in? Aren't you supposed to be the ones who might be like, yeah, I don't agree with what he's doing, but it's my son who swung at the woman. And it's my son who needs to go to the, you know, the therapist and get sorted out if he's suffering from PTSD. And it's me as a mother who, if he can't figure that out because he's mad, insane, then I'll help him. Where's that? Oh, no, no, we're the party of personal responsibility. We need our guns, government out of it, but it's your fault when we want it to be. Don't see that woman or most people who think that way paradigm shifting in any positive way anytime soon, although I wish it for you, because it must suck blaming other people all the time and feeling attacked all the time. I know it because I've been there. And I'm about to go visit an environment in 10 minutes where that thinking runs rampant. That said, my friends, I'm going to cut this short because when I get back today, I want to add a little tune. I was encouraged by a couple people enjoying the music on the last one, and I know what I want to add. So I'm going to end the chatting portion of Chatting Between Takes, Bill Burr, TM, but I am going to kick into a little bit of music. I think I need a little bit of music. And if I had to fucking listen to me talk this long about all this bullshit, I'd want a little musical break too. Hey, everybody. Okay, so this podcast has been all over the place. I don't really care. I care about the podcast. I'm actually really excited to post this one. But I'm not worried that it's been 3 days since this. One thing I want to say. We just had the Bell Let's Talk Media Day. First off, good on you, Bell. Way to go. Ma Bell, I got the ill communication.
Ma Bell. But if I'm a billion-dollar corporation, or by the way, even myself, I want to make sure I try and give some back, whether it's through sweat equity, helping people out with my time, or through donating, you know. So good on them, whatever. So one thing I want to talk about, though, I've talked about this in the podcast a bit, is mental health. I'm going through it with my family right now, and you know, all the drinking and drugging I was doing was definitely a version of insanity. But once I got rid of that, I think around 2009, I think that year's a bit of a write-off for me. I was pretty much depressed to the point where not much was happening other than what needed to happen, if that, for about a year. And I'm talking more than low-grade depression. Now, part of me knew that drugs in my system weren't going to be the solution, so I decided not to go on any kind of antidepressant. But again, I just want to be real honest and open because there's no reason not to be, you know. I worked out real heavy with weights in 2010, and I spent a lot of time in therapy and group recovery and depressed in 2009. And I've talked on the podcast. I don't want to do all the details about how that kind of broke. But I will say that it's never been as bad since. It still happens. Even this January is a bit of a gloomy month for me. Life's good, work's good, Emily's good, karate's good, health's good. But internally, I'm feeling slow. I'm feeling a little bit gray. And I just say all this because if you're going through any of this stuff, we do have a stigma about it. There's no two ways about it. I'd rather tell you that I fucking shot heroin than that I'm depressed or have ever been. Because to me, that's a bigger failure. The one thing has a coolness about it. The other's just, yeah, that's lame. And that's as a guy who promotes and supports this open kind of dialogue. So I just want to put that out there. If you're struggling with this kind of stuff, it's the most important thing in the world. The way we think and feel, it's our vessel. You know, if that boat is letting in the wrong kind of water or whatever, I don't want to search for an analogy. I'm just saying, if everything is through a lens of hating yourself or a lens of loathing or you have no energy and it's not related to smoking or diet or anything, you know, get some help and be proud to ask for it. I just want to throw that out there. Okay, I'm about to set this mic down and play a little tune. I'm not going to set all the mics up and everything. Hannah, this one's for you because you said how much you like the music, but it's for all y'all. I want to do a little Bowie next time, but right now I want to do just a verse and a chorus of some Glenn Frey and the Eagles. All right, here we go. Just restrung the guitar. Should be pretty bouncy and we'll probably go out of tune, but good enough for the campfire.
I like the way you spark, babe. Against your skin so brown. I want to sleep with you in the desert tonight, with a million stars all around. I've got a
man, I love that song. Sleep tight, Mr. Glenn Frey. Sleep tight. Thanks for all the music. All right, that's a wrap on Chatting Between Takes. We'll talk to you next time.